You're with John Cleary on ABC Local Radio and on Radio Australia.
Thanks for joining us on Sunday night. In this hour, in a few moments' time, we're going to meet an Australian grandma who's taken her life in her hands. She's lived an adventurous life as a quiet Quaker. She's now taken the world stage in defence of children and is heading off shortly to the Middle East to look at the tense issues between Palestinians and Israelis and how peace can be brought to that troubled land. Helen Bayes is our guest in this hour. Here's a piece of music selected by Helen. It's Melanie Safka.
There's a chance peace will come in your life. Please buy one. There's a chance peace will come in your life. Please buy one. Sometimes when I am feeling as big as the land, with a velvet hill in the small of my back, and my hands are playing the sand. Are swimming in all of the waters, all of the rivers are givers to the ocean according to plan, according to man. Well, sometimes when I am feeling so grand, and I become
of Melanie Safka there. You may not have heard of Melanie Safka for many years, one or two hits along the way. It was chosen by our guest this evening. Our guest is somebody who has taken the message of peace quite seriously. An Australian who, working through one of probably the world's best known peace agencies, the Quakers, has carved a niche in a territory that many of us are concerned about today. Young children, particularly the issues of child labour, juvenile justice and sexual exploitation. Helen Bayes has become a campaigner against mandatory sentencing laws in Western Australia as they affect young people, and has recently come to the attention of the international community. She is president of the International General Assembly of the Defence for Children International. Helen, welcome to the program.
Hello, John.
Helen, quite a career. Your background is as a Quaker. I guess most people ask, oh, well, is she just doing it because it's a religious thing to do?
I'd have to say yes to that question. But I feel very deeply concerned about human suffering and in all its forms, and in particular suffering which is created by other human beings. You know, the man's inhumanity to man thing. And it seems to me, this is a faith belief that I have, that each of us have a presence of the spirit, the great spirit, or God, or whatever you want to call it, really. The words don't matter to me. But there is a divine presence in each of us. And we are kind of called by that to act well and not to do damage to the presence of that divine quality in other human beings as well.
It also implies a pretty specific understanding of the nature of God. That is, it's a God who really does care about this world as much as people's fate in the next, whatever that may be.
Yes, absolutely. For me, God is very present all the time, really. And my effort in that relationship is to strive to stay aware of the presence and what the presence means. And for me, the presence means absolutely everything. So, you know, in the great scheme of things, I'm very small, very minor. On the other hand, I am part of that magnificent, you know, the magnificence of creation. And it is important that I engage with that and live according to my understanding of that. Yes.
That first tune we played, a selection of yours, Melanie Safka, Peace Will Come According to a Plan, betokens some sense of order in the universe, that you do believe there is something to be made sense of here, and that each of us has a part to play in that.
Yes, I think we're part of a holy experiment. And that holy experiment is about creation in all its positive aspects, and creation in its most positive form is, of course, peaceful. It is, of course, respectful of all sorts, all aspects, and all elements of creation. And it is about each of us finding that kind of deeply peaceful relationship with all other aspects of creation, yes.
You're on Sunday night on ABC Radio Around Australia. John Cleary with you. Our guest is Helen Bayes, President of the International General Assembly of the Defence for Children International. Helen, that's a big phrase. You're off to Geneva shortly to chair an international assembly of the organisation, yet your connections to this stem very much from your own local experience and your own local commitments. What began this journey for you, this particular aspect of the journey?
At a very personal level, I remarried in the mid-1980s, and my husband and I decided that we wanted to have children of the marriage, but you know, we were into our 40s, and so we decided to go in for adoption, and we looked, in particular, I looked very carefully at the ethics of that because it was controversial at the time and in some ways still is, and I came across the work that was being done at the UN to protect children from trafficking and to make sure that inter-country adoption, adoption generally, but in particular inter-country, where children are so much at sort of risk and the issues are much more complex, to protect them from harm and exploitation. And I was very impressed. It kind of hit my heart, really, the principles that were being proposed by the UN then through the human rights system. And through that, I became aware of work which Defence for Children International was doing on all sorts of issues of exploitation of children, including, as you said, child labour, child trafficking, child prostitution, sexual exploitation of children, and the whole issue of violence against children and the lack of respect for children as human beings, and the sense that, you know, children are the private property of families, for instance, and the wider community should not interfere with what's going on in families. You know, those issues are very complex.
There's a couple of things I'd like to take up there, but first let's get to that that first starting point, this concern that for the abuse of children in a whole range of ways. Most people associate that with the 19th century. They think of Charles Dickens, and they think of the child labour laws and the fight by people like the Earl of Shaftesbury to end the exploitation of children in factories. And they think, well, it's all part of another world, really, and we've moved on from that. You're suggesting that those things are still with us, but their scale is somewhat different.
We do like to look back on history and say that history has solved all these problems, and because we personally don't experience it in our own lives or our own communities, that therefore that problem's been done away with. But of course, around the world, it hasn't. There are many countries in the world where there is terrible exploitation of children, and we in our country benefit from that. We as individuals benefit from child labour. Some of us, I'm afraid to say, go overseas for sex with children. The whole issue of trafficking of children for inter-country adoption hit the press recently because of reports which have come out that show that there are a few, possibly 30 or so, children in Australia who have been adopted here, whose origin in the adoption system was a form of trafficking, that is, that they were sold and bought.
Yes, that the agencies in India in particular,
in this case,
were actually front agencies or
perhaps
even gulled themselves. I mean, who knows? But the children were actually stolen from their parents.
And the problem here is in India to do with the regulation of the process and the, you know, the review and the accountability of the agencies that are licensed to undertake inter-country adoption. And so the problem is not specifically an Australian one, although because you have international agreements between Australia and the countries where inter-country adoption can take place with for Australians, there's international agreements there. And of course, you know, now there are families who are distressed and concerned about the story behind the children being made available to them. And of course, the children now have a family which they're probably, you know, almost certainly very much integrated to. They're going to school here and they've adopted an Australian identity. So the issues are... there's an example in Australia, in Canberra, where I live, where a family actually discovered this and then went over to India and actually met the birth mother of their children and now have a very positive relationship with her and children who were born subsequent to the sale of the children by her husband, her ex-husband. And this is a very interesting story. And it's the sort of thing where, as an example of what we, from an ethical stand, can do and can bring into the light and can take action to prevent this sort of thing happening.
You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio Around Australia. John Cleary with you. Our guest is Helen Bayes. Helen is a Quaker peace activist and president of the International General Assembly of the Defence for Children International, soon to head off to preside at the International Assembly meeting in Geneva. Helen, let's have another piece of music, something that reflects something of the way in which these issues are broader than ourselves, that they cover all people in all corners of the globe, really. Hevenu Shalom Aleinu, we brought peace upon us.
It's a song which I found on YouTube while I was actually looking for the Israeli Jewish folk song, Havenu Shalom Alechem. And this is a different song, but it's been produced and sung by Israeli Jews as well as Israeli Arabs and Palestinian young people using a vast range of instruments, traditional and modern, and sung with great joy and great sense of unity of heart and vision and hope. And I'm about to go to Palestine and Israel as well as part of this overseas trip, and so I thought it's a wonderful song to listen to.
We brought Peace Upon Us, a selection of music requested by our guest, Helen Bays. I'd like to bring the conversation for a moment into our own backyard. You mentioned earlier the issue not just of child exploitation, but the way in which we tend to develop protective mechanisms that say, well, look, children are the preserve of parents, and we don't need to get into that area. That's a particularly difficult one in Western societies like Australia, and in some ways the churches, of whom you're a part, are one of the big problem areas, because there's been a lot of concern expressed from some church bodies, some more conservative ones, about groups like the UN or others getting into charters for children's rights and other things. They talk about children being able to divorce their parents and breaking down the whole family structure of the interference of these groups who want to get in and just destroy the structure of parental authority. This becomes a genuine problem. This is difficult turf to negotiate.
Yes. The issue of parental authority is, of course, it's very important indeed that parents have authority in their families, that they are the principal carers of their children, that they convey their values and their ethical standards and their faith and their way of life to their children. And the UN and UN bodies and NGOs working on human rights don't want to interfere with that at all.
So how did you feel about those campaigns that were run a few years ago by Christian bodies concerned to get the UN out of the lives of parents and children?
Well, I actually thought it was a kind of misunderstanding of what the international standards are aimed for, a kind of almost fearful response. And what the UN human rights system does is define a set of ethical standards, if you like. That's what moves me, is the ethical standards built into these human rights instruments, but also a series of processes which give power to the powerless, really, in relation to human rights. And children are clearly powerless in lots of situations. And if their parents are not acting according to their child's best interests, if the parents are actually being violent towards their children or using the children as a property that can be exploited, or they are not giving their children the opportunity to grow up and experience all the sorts of things that we know children will really benefit from, then it seems right to me that there are mechanisms to intervene there and to educate the parents, to support the parents, and to educate and support the children as well. So, and of course, we do all this sort of thing in relation to adults all over the place, and people don't say that that there shouldn't be protections against protections for adults about domestic violence or exploitation or so on. And it's simply an expansion of those principles in relation to children.
It seemed to get caught up in a wider political campaign that seemed to be driven by right-wing politics as much as anything else. And that was the sort of whole one-world government mystique, which tends to be a mishmash of both right-wing politics and a sort of perverse form of fundamentalist Christianity.
Yes, the fundamentalist perspective is, as I see it, is very literal. In each of the faiths, actually, the fundamentalist level of those communities, the sort of groups, tend to be very literal in their interpretation of holy texts, and to be, in particular, old holy texts, because of a belief that somehow these holy texts have been delivered magically, mystically by God to the earth and to human beings. My view about this is that many of those holy texts, if not all of them, I'm not an expert on all of them, but holy texts are, their origin is being written in the spirit or in that sense of relationship with the holy, with the presence of the divine. There is a deep movement inside the people who write the stories. But we need to listen to we need to read and listen to those stories in the context of their times, and then we need to translate the deep message in them to our times. And very often, actually, the message is about justice, it's about peace, it's about right relationship, it's about love. And if we translate those messages into our time, then we don't do the literal things which are in the stories. We do what is relevant to us today. And that seems to me, I suppose I'm saying there, I'm trying to describe the process that goes on in myself. When I read the Bible, the Old and the New Testament, or religious poetry, or the writings and speeches of great religious leaders who have a deep faith behind what they say, and yet speak to our times.
You've brought to our attention one of the great speeches which has impressed you, and it's one that certainly I was unaware of, Martin Luther King Jr., but none of the great speeches which I've seen sort of, reprinted in books or hear from time to time, and only a month or so ago we celebrated the I Have a Dream speech, and Barack Obama chose that day on which to launch his acceptance of the bid for the presidential chair in the United States. But you've dug deeply into Martin Luther King Jr. and discovered a speech that he gave to a Quaker group. And this is, yes, something that you, well, introduce it for us, because it really does contain some powerful principles.
Yes, this is a speech by Martin Luther King to the gathering of Quakers of the Friends General Conference in 1958, so it's 50 years ago. And it was about 10 years before Martin Luther King died. And so it seems to me to be a very important and very interesting speech, because it's his description of him, in a sense, coming out as a leader for nonviolence and for racial justice. And he's expressing those views that he had, which he developed through his faith, the clarity that he'd come to through his own faith and his place in the churches and in his life and history, and then expressing this as the vision of the way forward. So he's speaking about nonviolence and racial justice to a very large gathering of Quakers. And I listened to it and I was so profoundly moved by what he was saying. What his message is so powerful and true. It's so deeply true. You listen to it and say, yes, this is the way things are. This is the way things should be. This is what I want to be involved in. And the bit that I've chosen is where Martin Luther King is speaking. He's voicing what he is advocating that Black Americans adopt as their position on their struggle for justice. And so he's expressing the core values of nonviolent resistance and the kind of ethical position, the human relationship position that he believes is the most constructive one for the long term, to be taken by Black Americans in their struggle and in their dealing with the violence that's being meted out to them.
Martin Luther King Jr. in 1958, speaking to the American Religious Society of Friends, the Quakers.
We will win the hearts and the souls of the perpetrators of the evil system. The nonviolent resistor recognizes the transforming value and the redemptive value of suffering. That is another basic thing about nonviolent resistance. It is this: the nonviolent resistor not only avoids external physical violence, but he avoids internal violence of spirit. He not only refuses to shoot his opponent, but he refuses to hate him. The oppressed people of the world must not succumb to the temptation of becoming bitter or indulging in hate campaigns. We must somehow come to see that this leads us only deeper and deeper into the mire. To return hate for hate does nothing but intensify the existence of hate and evil in the universe. Somehow violence begets violence, toughness begets a greater toughness, force begets a greater force. It is all a descending spiral, ending in destruction for all. The old eye for an eye philosophy ends up leaving everybody blind. So somehow people in this universe must have sense enough and morality enough to return love for hate. Nonviolence brings that love into being alongside the determination not to use physical violence.
Now, Martin Luther King Jr., 1958, 50 years ago this year, a young man headed to a fate which, though it profoundly affected all of us, led ultimately to tragedy for him. It's interesting to speculate that this year may see the election of the first Black president 50 years after Martin Luther King's speech to the American Society of Friends. It's a selection of our guest, Helen Bayes. Helen, thanks for bringing that to us. I guess in your life, that in some ways is an expression of values that you hold quite deeply. Where did those values come for you? What was it that made you decide this? The life of the Society of Friends is a life I want to commit myself to?
I grew up in a Quaker family, which I think is a very special blessing for me. I went to a lot of Quaker meetings and young friends gatherings and so forth during my childhood and teens. And I guess what happened in me is a growth of an understanding of the reality of this divine presence and the reality of unconditional love towards me and of guidance in my life for each practical step that I am able to take, that I'm opportunities that are there for me.
And what led you then into the concern for children specifically? Because you've founded the Defence for Children in Australia.
That's right.
So there must have been some trigger, and you said, I've got to do this. Now, we spoke earlier quite generally about it, but the actual organisational structure itself, where did it spring from?
I can trace in my right back into quite early childhood experiences a sort of intuitive sense of justice to do with children. And I think it just engaged in me, and I can't explain it. It's like some people work in some areas, and I chose to work in this because it had such deep meaning for me.
Well, let's talk about the international body then that you're now the president of, because this has grown. How has this developed, and to what extent is the body now representative in a number of countries and operating, and what are its prime focus?
I'd like to clarify a couple of points about my role here. I'm the president of the International General Assembly, but that's the president of the particular event which is going to take place.
Be the presiding officer.
I'll be the kind of clerk or the or the facilitator of the sharing and the decision-making process. My role there doesn't continue after the event, but it's a great honour and a very important thing to do well. So it's actually in Brussels, not in Geneva, and it's associated with a conference which will be held at the same time, which I will also attend, on violence in the juvenile justice system. And at the meeting and at the conference, there will be people from all over Africa, all over Latin America, quite a lot of places in Europe, some North Americans, and a few Asia and Australasia presence as well.
This one has particular bite in Australia, though, doesn't it? Because we've got mandatory detention laws, particularly in the north and in Western Australia, which must have a direct impact on kids.
Yes, the mandatory detention laws, where I was involved in a very strong campaign in the Northern Territory, were substantially softened. They still apply in Western Australia, but they were never quite so harsh as the ones that were in the Northern Territory, which is why the campaign focused on that. Mandatory detention means that what that little phrase captures is the principle that when a young person commits a certain kind of offence or a particular number of offences or over a particular time or something, they automatically go into detention. There is no consideration, no flexibility in the courts for questions of their family circumstances or their other needs or their special needs such as disabilities or so forth or their where their family live. And no consideration of what the impact of detention is going to have on them as an individual. And this is completely contrary to human rights, both the human rights that are described for all individuals as well as the human rights specifically for children. So I became involved in that campaign. And as I say, those laws were softened in the Northern Territory. And it's really important that when children are going through, when they're having some experience of conflict with the law and they're going through the court system and they are being charged and facing the possibility of some consequence of some action that they've taken in the legal system, it's very important that we take their circumstances into full account and that what is meted out to them is something which is in their best interests, that will actually help them in their growing up, not be another barrier or another hurdle for them to overcome.
The attitude of the legal system towards children is heavily influenced by politics. Politicians, after all, make the laws. There has been a general shift over the last 10 or 15 years, I think first coming out of the United States, to actually be more flexible on the interpretation of laws pertaining to children. And this can have a negative side as well as a positive side, but you get this constant call, and it's even law in some places in the United States, that for certain offences, juveniles should be treated as adults. And this can result in very harsh penalties being meted out to juveniles. Do you find this problematic, to say the least?
Yes, there are a number of states in the United States which still execute prisoners who committed the offence for which they're being executed as a child. And this is completely wrong, completely contrary to the principles of the Convention on the Rights of the Child.
But it seems almost completely wrong in terms of the definition of the law itself. That is, if the law takes the trouble to say we can define people as juveniles, it does that on the basis that juveniles in some way are inherently different from adults. That is, they do not have the same capacities as adults and therefore cannot be judged in the same way. It seems to me if you accept that fundamental proposition, then it's a contradiction in terms in the law itself in actually being able to charge juveniles as adults for some offence which you deem heinous.
Yes, yes. You've hit the nail on the head. I think that's the principle, you know, sort of the mixture, the confusion, really. But in terms of the public attitude to these things, young people are more are better educated. They're more exposed to all sorts of things. They in many ways they're more confident than they've ever been in the past. Certainly in recent Western culture. And so they're more assertive. They have access to more opportunities. They can take more, much stronger control of their own lives much earlier. And I think people worry about that. I mean, ordinary.
There's a culture
people
of resentment against kids in some way.
Well, I worry about my teenage children and my grandchildren and how they're going to use all this opportunity, and I don't want them to come to any harm. So, of course, in some ways, there are things that you want to, as an adult looking at these precious children, want to somehow restrict. But at the same time, being restrictive is not the way forward, of course. And being punitive, this is the other aspect of it. In what way do we see punishment as relevant, punitive consequences as relevant to in our relationship with teenagers? Teenagers are on the cusp of becoming adult. In some respects, they are fully grown. They may be physically close to fully grown. They've had lots of experiences. They've got strong opinions. They've got the hormones buzzing. They've got this sense of I'm going to be a full human being. I'm going to be independent. I'm going to run my own life, and all that is positive. But when they're in a situation where there are lots of things which are dangerous, and where there are a lot of things which are a lot of people who will, you know, inverted commas, lead them astray, we want to protect them, don't we? We don't want that to happen. And so you get public controversy coming up from parents and community groups and faith groups who really are coming from the right place very often, but who are afraid for their children and their young people, and who want to perhaps use either restrictions, which don't go down well with the young people, or punitive consequences.
Vengeance and justice get confused here, don't they?
They do. And I must say, I think that all this relates back to quite a lot of religious teachings, that if you are taught and believe in a punitive God, one who strikes you from up above and or is going to condemn you to some dreadful eternal existence for, you know, sins and offences committed in this life, then I think what then happens is that the faith community which carries those views begins to see themselves as responsible for doing the punishment, to do the punishment here on this earth in order to kind of act for God, and also in order to prevent vulnerable people, young people in this particular context that we're talking of, from endangering their souls. And so you get the connection between faith and the concept of God and the sense of what the relationship with God is, with punitive behaviour, with very restrictive behaviour, with rigid rules and so on. And in my construction of all this, God to me is everything that is good. God gives us unconditional love, is present with us all the time, loving us and caring for us and helping us on with this challenge that we've been given of living in creation, in our bodies, in our environment as it is today. And so I don't see punishment as being relevant here. Certainly consequences need to be taught, but not judgment. Not punitive measures which cause suffering, because force, and this is where it comes back to my pacifist perspective, force does not work. It does not convey the right message. It doesn't convey the right message about creation and the divine in us, and it doesn't help the person to grow into a peaceful way of living and a trustful way of living about the people that they encounter around them.
You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio around Australia and across the World Wide Web. Our guest is Helen Bayes, a Quaker activist and president of the Defence for Children International. Helen, you also are entering into a world which justice is a very hard concept to define. We spoke earlier, we used a song earlier from Israel. The Middle East is a place where justice seems so difficult to discern. You're entering into a world in which rights and wrongs go back generations. This is something that most people just see as intractable.
Yes, I'm about to go to, after I finished at the conference in Brussels, I'm going to Israel and Palestine on a Christian peacemaker team delegation. And that's for 2 weeks. There'll be about 10 of us.
See, this is called real cockeyed optimism, isn't it?
No, it's real. It's real. It's the vision, you know. It's what we have to hang on to because it's possible. We'll be talking to quite a wide selection of the peace organizations in Israel and Palestine. And I've got a list here which says that there are 18 very substantial organizations of Jewish and Muslim and Christian faith or secular doing enormous amount of work to bring peace to that very troubled region. And in my faith, I go back to the words of George Fox in the 17th century in the UK, where he said when he was describing his commitment to nonviolence, which he didn't call it that then, commitment to peace, was, I live in that condition that takes away the cause of wars. Now, that's what I'm trying to do. I try to do that in my daily life. I try to do that in my hobbies. I try to do that in the way in which I spend my time and my opportunities. And this going to Israel and Palestine is, for me, I guess, an expression of my desire to actually do something much more radical than what I have the opportunity to do in my daily life. We basically live in a peaceful community here. I don't encounter much of the sorts of things that I've been talking about, but I want to engage with this issue at a very radical level. And it's very likely that the delegation that we're going on will undertake some form of active public resistance to the system that is so oppressive to the Palestinians and which is the source of a lot of the violence which goes backwards and forwards between the Palestinians and the Israelis, and seems to be such a sort of boiling melting pot of conflict.
See, at the personal level, you can it's quite clear that there are many repressive actions taken against the Palestinians. Yet if you enlarge that out to a general level, you can say, well, hang on though, at a mega level, Israel is the one functioning democracy in the region, albeit inadequate. Across the border, where the Palestinians are in the camps, those camps have been held there like that for 50 years by the governments of those states deliberately to generate the sort of injustices that fuel the quest for martyrdom. So that whilst the solution at the micro may be to sort of encourage people to talk to each other, you've still got macro problems in which the rights and wrongs may be reversed.
Yes, it's very complicated over there, and I need to learn more about it. But I have been going. I've been to Israel and when I could to Palestine. For four times before this occasion, since 1963 was my first visit. And I've seen the country change, the culture of and the social situation changed very dramatically from those from the mid-1960s, where there was such idealism about the future of the Jewish the expression of Judaism in that part of the world. And I have to say that when I went to Israel in 1963, I had no idea that there were, over the border, huge refugee camps of Palestinians who had fled Israel because of their fear, who were being not integrated or given opportunity to return, and who were in refugee camps, which are now so formed that they're like little towns where whole generations and whole families have always lived, and there's no memory of, or very little memory of, going back to where they came from. You know, my feeling about this is that there are political solutions which need to be taken, steps which need to be taken to ease the conflict, to establish a settled pattern. Those political steps need to be ones which redress the last 20, 40 years of oppression of the Palestinian people, which brings a sense of safety to the Israelis as well, and which create a situation where a vision for the future can be arrived at. And you know, the vision for the future includes good neighbourly relations between these people, possibly a single state, an international city of Jerusalem, where everyone can go and worship, and there isn't danger to anyone, because Jerusalem is such a central place in the religious belief of three faiths, major world faiths.
The holy city.
Absolutely.
Helen Bayes, it's been great to talk to you.
We've
just about run out of time. We're going to have to wind the conversation up. You'll have to ring us and tell us about your adventures when you get back.
I'd love to talk to you again. Thank you, John.
Helen Bayes, one of Australia's more adventurous grandmothers, heading off on a journey for the peace and safety of the children of the world. Helen, will finish with one of the great fighters for justice, another one of the favourites you've chosen, and somebody that we use when we get the opportunity on Sunday nights, Paul Robeson.
John, can I just tell you why I chose this song? The song is called A Perfect Day, and it might sound a really odd song to choose for somebody who is so, you know, aware and concerned about all the dreadful things that happen to children and the dreadful things that are happening in Palestine and Israel. But as a peacemaker, for me, A Perfect Day is doing what I feel is right during that day, and doing it with a sense of humility, that I'm just one person, but I have a life and I can give myself to this. And the song is, it brings the image for me of Paul Robeson as a grandfatherly black American sitting on his veranda, looking over the fields where maybe he was, his family were slaves, looking over all that, knowing all that suffering, but also being able to know that this day has been a perfect day, and that there is peace, there is inward peace, and there is the possibility of global peace.
Helen Bayes, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
A perfect day, and you sit alone with your thought, while the chimes ring out with a carol gay for the joy that the day has brought. Do you think what the end of a tired heart, when the sun goes down with a flaming ray, and the dear friends have to part?
Paul Robeson, the end of a perfect day. Indeed it is. You're on Sunday night on ABC Radio Around Australia. Paul Robeson was the selection of our guest, Helen Bayes.